headlines, Russia warns Ukraine's neighbors that offering their airfields to Kiev's military aircraft for attacks on Russian forces may be regarded as their involvement in an armed conflict. U.S. gasoline prices jump 11% in a week to hit their highest since 2008, as Western sanctions on Russia over its Ukraine operation reduce Moscow's ability to export oil. Also ahead, Pakistan's premier slams Islamabad-based Western envoys for urging his country to condemn Russia's operation in Ukraine, saying Pakistan is not their slave. That's also in the headlines. Thank you for joining us. And our top story, Russia's President Vladimir Putin says Moscow plans to achieve its objectives in Ukraine either through diplomacy or military means. Putin made the remark during a phone call with his French counterpart. A French official said Putin also demanded the recognition of Crimea as part of Russian territory, as well as the independence of the two Ukrainian breakaway regions recently recognized by Russia. In a separate call, Putin told his Turkish counterpart that Moscow will end the operation once its demands are met and Ukraine stops fighting. On the ground, heavy fighting continues in major Ukrainian cities, including the capital Kiev. The UN chief has called for a pause in the fighting to allow safe passages for civilians. A UN monitor says some 360 civilians have been killed since the conflict began. The Ukrainian president says Russia is now preparing to shell the southern city of Odessa.
They are preparing to bomb Odessa. This is going to be a military crime. This is going to be a historical crime and a war crime.
Zelensky also slammed the West for rejecting his demand to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine or arm it with fighter jets. He said, quote, "You want us to be killed very slowly." In the meantime, Russia warns Ukraine's neighbors, including NATO member Romania, against hosting Kiev's military aircraft, saying they could end up being involved in an armed conflict. This, as a Ukrainian official says, some 20,000 foreign mercenaries have arrived in Ukraine to fight Russians. Denmark has given the green light for its nationals to take up arms in Ukraine. The British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss gave similar permission to UK nationals. However, the head of the UK Armed Forces says it would be unlawful and unhelpful for Britons to go and fight against Russia. So, what does the situation look like on the ground in Ukraine? Here's a map showing Russians' advances and the areas under their control. So, the Russians are pressing inward from the north, east, and south. They are closing in on the capital, Kiev, with a major column of military vehicles stationed outside and aerial bombardments continuing inside. However, the capital is still holding. In the east, Kharkiv, another major city, also remains in Ukrainian hands despite intense bombings. Russian forces are also pressing an offensive through the pro-Russian Donetsk and Luhansk regions. In the northeast, heavy fighting has taken place around and inside the city of Sumy. To the south, Russia has besieged the strategic city of Mariupol, which would link forces pushing north from Crimea to those from the east. Russian troops also appear to be moving on Mykolaiv to the northwest of Kherson, which they seized last week. Joining us for more on that is James Jatteras, former U.S. diplomat and foreign policy analyst from Washington, and also Sarah Flanders, International Action Center from New York. James, if I could start with you, we're hearing from some Western officials that occupied people, referring to Ukraine here, have the absolute right to resist against the occupier. Absolutely, UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss said. I'm just wondering, does that rule also apply to other occupied regions, such as in Palestine or Syria or Iraq?
I don't know if they have a right to do it, but it certainly seems to me a very bad idea. that if we look at the way the Russian forces are advancing, they've pretty much shaped the battlefield. They now have put these cities in a very impossible position to defend. And I think similar to what we saw in Aleppo in Syria, they're going to try to pressure them to for these military forces, both regular military and militias, to leave. I don't think too many actual regular civilians are going to want to get themselves killed in a war that they can't fight. And I think that's why it's really they can't win. That's why it's really unconscionable for these Western governments that are not really going to do much to address the situation in Ukraine directly, nor do I think they should, to encourage them to keep fighting and keep dying for essentially propaganda purposes.
Right. Sarah, just a similar question. Denmark has given the green light for its nationals to take up arms in Ukraine. The British Foreign Secretary, as I mentioned, this trust gave similar permission to UK nationals. Would they do the same to other regions that are occupied in the world, such as Palestine or Syria or Iraq?
Well, I think they have done the same in their use of hundreds of thousands of mercenary fighters and jihadists and other forces in Syria. We can look back years ago to Afghanistan or look at the Contra forces in Nicaragua. The U.S. has used again and again proxy forces in their wars. At the same time, of course, they object to people's wars. And there's a big difference between resisting and fighting for their own sovereignty and what is happening today when the U.S. is using Ukraine as a way of battering Russia along its 1,200-mile border. The constant use for 8 years of U.S. heavy equipment, U.S. advisors, which are really U.S. troops, but they're, quote, advisors, mercenaries, fascist forces, and Contras. Now they want to escalate that. But they have been doing this for 8 years. And if they wanted this war to end today, it would end today if the U.S. stopped pumping in all of these millions, billions of dollars of lethal arms, U.S. advisors into the Ukraine. So okay. I think we just got to look at how they're using Ukraine in order to fight a war against Russia.
James, would you agree with that? I mean, if you consider the, for example, Zelensky slamming the NATO for their slow action, is saying they want us to die or kill us very slowly. The U.S. is providing aircrafts, but not the aircrafts that Ukrainian pilots are trained to operate. Essentially, is the U.S. interested in ending this or prolonging this conflict?
Oh, clearly, the U.S. is interested in dragging it out and making it as bloody as possible and make sure as many ordinary Ukrainians get killed in the process. This idea of supplying jet fighters is absolutely absurd. I mean, if they do, they better supply them with Japanese pilots because it's going to be a kamikaze mission. They couldn't base them in Ukraine or they'd be destroyed along with the rest of the Ukrainian Air Force that's already been destroyed. And they can't base them in other countries like Poland or Romania because it would make those countries then targets. And the Russians have made it very clear that they would hit them. I think President Putin's comments were not very ambiguous. He said either the Ukrainians, what's left of the Ukrainian government, I'm not even sure how much authority Zelensky has at this point, either they will meet Russia's demands, which are very clear and unconditional, or they will continue with the military operation to its conclusion, which means then they will find somebody else that they put in place that they can make a deal with.
Let's find out the latest social media posts in reaction to the developing events in Eastern Europe. Okay, so I know the facts before you, Vac says. Who is paying for these mercenaries? Could it be US, Israeli, Zionists? Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov notes that Albania, Kosovo, Bosnia and are sending mercenaries to fight in Ukraine. Patrick Claflin says, when the US says it's saving Ukraine's democracy, that's BS. It's all about the geopolitical control of the oil and gas, and it sends a message to the European allies not to develop too cozy relationship with Russia, especially the Germans who heavily rely on Russian energy. Boomer says Ukraine, the new Syria, courtesy of the US and its NATO stooges, and what will befall the Ukrainian people? 20 years of mercenary insurgents supplied and armed by the US war industry, butchering men, women and children, for what? Rachel Pirani says, for no reason really. I guess you haven't noticed the Ukrainian regime's barbaric war against their own people for the last 8 years, right on Ukraine, on Russia, that is, its borders, and the millions and billions in weapons and US trainers militarizing Ukraine with guns pointed at Russia. That's an apparent response to the previous post. Sarah, this idea of mercenaries being sent to Ukraine, how is that going to help the situation?
It will help the U.S. inflame the situation further. We can't forget that this same tactic in Syria led to a third of the Syrian population being displaced by war, entire cities in ruin. However, it did not defeat Syria. And now they're using the same tactic in Ukraine to set Ukrainians against each other with a puppet government of their own making, to hammer a part of the country that refused fascist control. But really, they're doing all of this to make a war on Russia, to block the enormous amount of trade that had developed between Russia and the European Union, and the trade from China and Russia into the European Union. The European Union was the largest investor in Russia. The U.S. wants to break all of this, and they're determined to block it. They're determined to block it through the sanctions, and now they're determined to also block it through a war that will lay ruin to all of Ukraine. They have been deeply involved while Ukraine was supposedly neutral and not a NATO member, pumping in these arms for years. But now they're ratcheting it up much higher. And Biden openly announces this, 600 million more of heavy weapons, more U.S. advisors, and now mercenaries who are really the death machine. They have no progressive role whatsoever to play. And from all over the world, they're being recruited. Kosovo, that's absolutely true. From Syria, you can bet they have forces in Afghanistan. They have forces that they can pull from all over the world. And anyone who wants the paycheck.
And James, there's, you know, Russian President Vladimir Putin has made demands. And he also says he plans to end the conflict either through diplomacy or military means, as well, in addition to the demands that he has set out. Do you think he's going to get those demands? And do you think the military conflict will be resolved through military or diplomatic means?
If I had to guess, I would say it's probably going to be resolved militarily. I mean, look, we have essentially three wars going on here. We have the military conflict on the ground in Ukraine. We have the propaganda war that's been raging to demonize the Russians. And then we have the financial and economic war. As far as the war in Ukraine goes, yes, the Russians can, and I believe will, win the war on the ground in the very, very near future. The propaganda war, they really can't win. And that's why we see things talk about weapons and some kind of support from the West and mercenaries and so forth, because they want to keep the bleeding and dying going as long as possible, because it's very negative PR for the Russians being hyped by the world media. And then, of course, we have the financial and economic war that, okay, right now, yeah, sure, Russia will go through a rough patch, but Russia's above any other country in the world is pretty close to an autarky. Economically, I mean, look, even the sanctions against Iran, which is not in as strong a position as Russia is, did not work. And I think we're actually going to see a lot more pain in the West, especially in Europe, to some extent in the U.S., but even more in Europe. So this is going to go on for a while. There will be a new Cold War, I believe, for several years, possibly a generation. But what happens on the ground in Ukraine, I think that's going to wrap up relatively quickly. And then the Russians are just going to have to brass it out after that.
Interesting stuff. Let me thank our guests for their time. James Jatteris is a former U.S. diplomat and a foreign policy analyst joining us live from Washington, D.C. Also, Sarah Flanders with the International Action Center joining us from New York. Now, moving on, U.S. gasoline prices jumped 11% over the past week, the highest since 2008, as Western sanctions hamper Russia's ability to export crude oil. The national average price for a gallon of regular gas stood at around $4. Authorities say prices are likely to rise further. This, as the U.S. Secretary of State has said he held discussions with Europeans about banning Russian oil imports. Antony Blinken, however, stopped short of announcing an outright boycott. Ukraine's foreign minister has asked Western countries to completely stop importing Russian oil. Oil futures contracts have risen to their highest levels since July 2008. The Brent price hit almost $140 a barrel, while the price of the U.S. crude reached $130.50. Meanwhile, Russian banks say they're planning to issue cards using China's UnionPay system after Visa and MasterCard moved to suspend operations in Russia. Pakistan's Prime Minister has hit out at Islamabad-based Western envoys for their stance on the Russian military operation in Ukraine. Imran Khan says the envoys, who had urged his country to condemn Russia's actions in Ukraine, should not think that Pakistan is their slave. He said the diplomats shouldn't think they can diktat Islamabad. He said Pakistan is not taking sides with any country and will remain neutral. The premier added Islamabad would work with those trying to end the war in Ukraine. Earlier this week, the heads of 22 diplomatic missions, including those of EU member states, released a joint letter calling on Pakistan to support a UN General Assembly resolution condemning Russia's actions against Ukraine. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
There is no denying of the fact that the organized killers of peaceful Muslims are not Muslims, and there are no second thoughts on meting out justice to such godless elements who have no faith in any religion or school of thought, says Kayhan International staff writer in an article published under the heading Godless Elements Creating Sedition in Pakistan. Stay tuned for more. We are in the blessed month of Sha'ban, when the gates of paradise are flung open to the believers who adhere to the dynamic teachings of the Messenger of Mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and the humanitarian values expounded by his immaculate Ahlul Bayt, while the flames of hell leap to drag into the fiery bowels of the enemies of humanity, including the godless hypocrites who pose as Muslims to wantonly shed innocent Muslim blood. In a famous hadith recorded by both Sunni and Shia Muslims, the Prophet of Peace said, "When the first day of Sha'ban arrives, Satan spreads out his troops throughout the corners of the earth and its horizons, telling them to try to attract some of God's servants toward themselves. Indeed, God Almighty and Glorious also scatters his angels throughout the earth's quarters and horizons, telling them, 'Guide my servants and show them the right way,' whereat all of them will attain felicity through you, except such of them who refuse and are arrogant and rebellious. These join the party of Satan and enter his host." On March 4th, in the city of Peshawar in Pakistan, the hordes of Satan raised their ugly head to trigger bomb blasts at a mosque during the weekly Friday prayer, martyring scores of worshippers. The deadly terrorist attack also ended the miserable life of some of these godless perpetrators who might have been blown through remote control. If we discount the reports that they staged a suicidal attack by assaulting two police guards to enter the mosque and detonate explosive belts. Either way, these devils in human form, who are the avowed enemies of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and his immaculate, and masquerade as Muslims to kill and cause sedition amongst Muslims, chose to plunge into the eternal inferno, while the worshippers who lost their life in prayer in the Kuch-e-Risaladar Mosque are definitely enjoying the bliss of paradise, leaving behind in the world grieving parents, widows, and orphans. As we go to the press, over 70 innocent souls have so far lost their life and over 200 others injured. But the questions persist. Why proper security measures are not taken by authorities? And why does the government of Pakistan hesitate from arresting and exterminating these un-Islamic outfits who, as is crystal clear, despite their use Muslim names, have no connection to Islam? Iran's foreign ministry spokesman urged the Pakistani government and security officials to adopt necessary strategies and take serious measures to prevent criminal activities of terrorists. Saeed Khatibzadeh said the Peshawar terrorist attack was aimed at creating sectarian divisions and is definitely against the unity of the Ummah. It is obvious from videos and photos circulating online with ambulances rushing through congested narrow streets and ferrying the wounded to hospitals and the senior officials right from the president and the prime minister of the country offering condolences to the bereaved family members that the authorities are sparing no efforts in their duties to the victimized citizens. Yet the question arises, what is the solution to these recurring bouts of terrorism? Why Pakistan's blasphemy laws are not applied to these terrorist outfits on the payroll of the CIA and the Zionist splinter Muslim ranks? There is no denying of the fact that the organized killers of peaceful Muslims are not Muslims, and there are no second thoughts on meting out justice to such godless elements who have no faith in any religion or school of thought. The Islamic Republic of Iran, as part of its friendly and fraternal policy towards Pakistan, is willing to cooperate in efforts to track down these criminal hordes of Satan in order to protect Muslims from harm, sedition, and disunity. Let us recall another passage from the famous hadith of the Prophet of Islam on doing good and abstaining from evil that was mentioned before. On the advent of the first of Sha'ban, God Almighty and Glorious commands the gates of paradise to open, and He commands the tree of Tuba, whereat it spreads its branches all over the world. Thereat, a herald of our Lord, Almighty and Glorious, calls out, O servants of God, these are the branches of the tree of Tuba. So catch hold of them so that they may lift you up toward paradise. And those are the branches of the tree of Zakum. Beware of them. Let them not draw you toward hell. The Prophet of Allah said, By him who sent me as a prophet with the truth, whoever approaches one of the doors of goodness and piety on this day adheres to a branch of the tree of Tuba and is taken toward paradise. And whoever approaches one of the doors of evil on this day is stuck to a branch of the Zakum tree, which draws him toward hell.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa al-Bahadali, and you are now listening to the program Viewpoints. Joining us in the studio today is a dear friend, Sheikh Muhammad Khani from the Islamic Seminary of Qom, and Dr. Ali Alawiyan. I welcome you both to this program, and I hope that we will have a fruitful discussion today. Bi-idhnillahi ta'ala.
Thank you very much.
Our topic today, dear friends, is about drugs, more specifically drug addiction. So I want to start out by asking the dear Sheikh Muhammad Khani about this problem of drug addiction. Do they need help or should we punish them?
See, it's quite a deep question, and sometimes it's very difficult to give a general answer, a general ruling to such a complicated or complex question. But just to make it clear, prevention is always better than cure. So first and foremost, if you want to talk about how to deal with drug addicts, addiction, we need to talk about how to prevent people from becoming drug addicts first and foremost. Talk about how we can prevent people from becoming drug addicts or become addicted to drugs. Because we have to look at the different reasons why people, they fall into drug addiction before talking about how to deal with them afterwards.
Right.
Or else we're just going to talk about how to solve some of the symptoms of the main issue or the root of the issue, which is why people, they actually become drug addicts in the first place.
Right.
So we need to solve that issue. And then afterwards, we can talk about whether they actually need help or they need to be punished. Because we have to define what is punishment in this situation. Are we talking about imprisonment? Are we talking about help in just acknowledging that they are drug addicts? We have to define the two words. In other words, we have to define help and punishment before we can talk about these two concepts being useful or not. So,
right. Then, Sheikh, let me ask you this question then. In Islam, how is drug addiction or just drugs generally viewed upon?
Of course, we know that the general ruling when it comes to drugs or any intoxicating drugs, it could be like alcohol, it could be anything else, they have the same ruling. It's haram, it's impermissible to consume it, therefore we're not allowed to consume it. So that's the general ruling. But if a person, he has an addiction, it's not always enough just to tell him that it's haram. Like, we need to help them before actually talking about punishments in form of imprisonment. Because normally when we talk about punishments, we normally talk about imprisonment.
Right.
We're talking about sending them to prison and so on and so forth. And that doesn't really solve the issue, because of the studies that we actually have shows that people, they are consuming drugs even in prisons, right?
Right.
So you're taking a person who is addicted to something, putting him with people that have exactly the same issue as this guy. So you're not solving the issue from the root. Therefore, you're actually making it worse sometimes in certain situations or certain cases, right?
Right, yeah.
So
help, in Islam, yes, if I might interrupt you, what is the punishment for using drugs or selling drugs perhaps? Is it also imprisonment?
Yeah, we have to separate the two. It's two different discussions. Selling drugs is something, consuming drugs is something else. If a person is addicted to it, he's hurting himself and his family and his close people, like people that are close to him. So this person, we need to help him if he actually wants to get rid of that addiction. But it needs to come from himself, right?
Right.
Because habits and addictions, you can't solve it by controlling other individuals. It needs to come from themselves.
Would you say then, dear Sheikh, that punishment is not an effective remedy or cure for a drug addiction?
I would say punishment is necessary when it comes to people selling drugs.
Only when selling drugs.
Important and exporting drugs and ruining people's lives. In other words, making money on selling drugs. So I would say that you need, that's punishment. Like, you need punishment for dealing with that. Yeah.
What about you, Dr. Alouyan? When is punishment suitable? Only when selling drugs and also when you are addicted to drugs?
Yeah, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam Muhammad and his purified progeny. The respected Sheikh gave a pretty good answer to the question that an addict is looked at as a sick person, so he has to be looked at with care and attention to see what kind of attention is needed to be given to him or her. But to actually issue a general verdict to see is punishment better or, let's say, encouragement or even taking care of them better, I think it differs case by case. As we have seen previously in our country here, we were imprisoning the people who were addicts. Now, I mean, the strategy changed, and now they are not being sent to the jails anymore, but they are looked after in some centers to leave this habit.
Right.
But for those, as Sheikh said properly, for those who are actually providing the drugs for the people, they need to be punished, because they unknowingly actually are providing some poisons for the lives of the people. Not only a person who is addicted to the drug is the only victim, but also the family and the whole society around him are the ones who are actually affected by the drug itself. So those who knowingly are actually selling or providing or importing and exporting these things need to be punished.
How should they be punished, if I might interrupt?
Look, punishment also, again, differs on the level of the knowledge of the person who had, which is actually is the duty of a judge to distinguish which one is needed to have. For example, a person who transfers, for example, 1,000 kilo of, for example,
cocaine.
Knowingly. So, as the rulings and the, let's say laws here in this country says, he has to be actually punished for the to be
executed.
It's life sentence now.
Yeah,
I think they removed the execution.
No execution now. Only imprisonment.
No, I think
for 1,000. I think.
Yeah, exactly. I think they actually removed capital punishment for people importing drugs. If I'm not mistaken,
As far as I know, it was for 1,000 kilo, or 1 ton. It was execution.
Oh, okay. So,
but it has changed. For example, for lower amounts.
Okay. Yeah.
For a lighter
also amounts. For drivers as well. That's what I think. Like people that are importing, but doing it because of I don't know,
necessity.
Poverty and they're poor. You know, they need to make money. They're forced into these things. Normally they're excused, but people that know they make a lot of money and they're the people that we consider to be
like Pablo Escobar in the West.
Exactly right. The people that are behind. The very scenes, true. Right? They're working behind the scenes. They normally get the capital punishment, if I'm not mistaken.
I need to check exactly for the... Because I think they have defined some, let's say, amounts for, for example, 5 kilo, 10 kilos, or let's say when it goes to 1,000 kilo. So the punishment differs. But for those, that is, I mean, the core of our discussion, which is about those who are addicted and have got this bad habit of being addicts. So for them, I think punishment is not a good solution. And as it has been understood well and it is being practiced, I think it is the way that is being practiced these days, that they need to be cared, to be cured.
Dear Sheikh, do we have any treatments mentioned in Islam, how we can treat such a problem?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like, I know there's a association right now that are dealing with these issues and finding solutions that they can actually implement in the different rehab centers around Iran. But if we have to look at what is drug addiction is basically a habit. It's an addiction, right? So it's something that you're used to because of the pleasure that are behind it. So normally when they discuss this in ethics, when it comes to habits, how to deal with habits, especially if it's a bad habit, normally they say that you have to replace that habit, especially if it's accompanied by some sort of a pleasure.
Right.
Because a person is normally not ready to sacrifice the pleasure if not it's replaced with something, right?
True. Yeah.
So if a person understands or he felt or experienced the pleasure of being a healthy person, normally he's not willing to sacrifice this pleasure for a pleasure that is lower than that. For example, eating unhealthy, there's some pleasure related to that as well.
Yeah.
But if you're a healthy person and you experience what it means to be healthy, you're normally not willing to eat unhealthy and experience that pleasure because you're going to sacrifice another and greater pleasure because of that.
So we should introduce something that is, I don't want to say as addictive, but as pleasurable as drugs.
We should find a solution and give him the tools to actually strengthen his own willpower. That's first and foremost, yeah? Because they have to come from outside. You cannot control people's addictions.
Right.
You cannot be like, you shouldn't do it if he wants to do it. Sooner or later, if he's under control, if he's in a controlled environment, sooner or later he's going to do it. You can control it for a period, for example. That's why we say, like, when we have to raise our children, we do exactly the same thing. We give them the willpower enough or strengthen their willpower enough so they can take the right decisions when they grow older instead of taking decisions for them, right? Because when they grow older and we're not there to control them anymore, they're not going to take the right decisions in life. So when it comes to drug addicts, it's quite similar. We have to strengthen their willpower first and foremost. Then second, we have to discuss how we can replace that habit or give him the tools to replace that habit because the addict himself has to do it. We can't replace habits for him. But we need to show him how to do it and give him the tools to do it. And then afterwards, try to give him some alternatives. So one of the things they normally do, if I'm not mistaken, you probably know better than me about it. In these rehab centers, they have a tendency to replace the pleasure of, for example, working out or having a healthy, like being healthy as an individual, and having a healthy diet next to working out, going to the gym. And that normally helps, not only from a psychological perspective, but also from a physical perspective, right? Because they get rid of the drugs and the habits or the need for having this drug physically.
So, may I add something to the explanations of the respected sheikh? When you're asking the respected sheikh, I want you to correct me if I'm mistaken.
Yeah,
what is the Islamic viewpoint on this? When sheikh is answering, actually, he's inducing from Islamic principles, like that of, for example, لَا تُلْقُوا بَيْدِكُمْ لَا تَهْلُكَ. So this is a general ruling. And then sheikh dissects the exact case that you are talking about. So it doesn't mean that in Islam, specifically on the issue of addicts, has some rulings on this specific case. Right. Though we have some
general rulings,
traditions and the hadith, even from imams, that even names the banj, what is called bang in the hadith itself, the name of the banj is mentioned. So, but I want to clarify the issue for the listeners and for ourselves to say that Sheikh actually is inducing the same way that you are asking him for a solution for or a remedy for the people who are afflicted with that actual affliction. So again, Sheikh is inducing from Islamic, different Islamic narrations and hadith and verdicts, and he comes and strengthening the willpower. So since it is, he knows that he understood the person earlier, he understood what the reason or the background of this illness is, that is a mental illness, something that has been affected due to some circumstances from the family side or from the friend side. So then Sheikh is giving you a prescription that is the strengthening the willpower or changing the environment of that person to go towards another, let's say, environment to let him forget whatever he was and to propose to him some new pleasures that is more motivating from the previous pleasures.
So and healthy as well, and healthy as well, right? It should be pleasurements that are healthy for himself, his environment, his families, because they exist as well, right?
Right, and with that, we will unfortunately have to end today's discussion because we are out of time. Dear Sheikh, I thank you for your insightful knowledge.
Jazakallah khair.
And I also thank the dear doctor for contributing to this discussion.
It was a great pleasure.
And I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. Fi amanillah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight.
Nationwide, only about 34% of the $45 billion Congress sent to states and cities for rental assistance had been distributed by October 31st, according to data from the U.S. Department of the Treasury. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sarah Kleiner Ryder. This article is published under the heading Rural America is Facing an Invisible Eviction Crisis. Stay tuned for more. About 70 miles northwest of the U.S. capital, in the affluent Virginia countryside and across the state line into West Virginia, there is a house on a hill in a deteriorating neighborhood. Inside sits Melody Schaefer, rubbing her red-rimmed eyes at the dining table. Her husband, Chris Pasco, paces between the dimly lit kitchen and living room. Paint peels from a nearby door frame. Schaefer repeatedly says when asked where they would go now that they were about to be evicted. I have no clue. It was the day before Thanksgiving. At the bustling Walmart down the road, shoppers filled their carts and potatoes, stuffing, green beans, and pumpkin pie, oblivious to the scene that had unfolded that morning in Country Courthouse. Jefferson County Magistrate Judge Vicky Dangelo had ruled in favor of three landlords and ordered the tenants living in their homes, including Schaefer and Pasco, to vacate by December 3rd. To wait and do this in the winter time, right before it gets cold, Schaefer trailed off. Statistically speaking, not much is known about evictions that are occurring outside the U.S. urban areas during the COVID-19 pandemic. There is no national system that monitors eviction cases in real time. The largest set of publicly available data is gathered by Princeton Eviction Lab, which is tracking cases in 6 states and 31 cities. Data in those urban areas show mixed trends. In places with few tenant protections, the number of cases is growing up, according to Eviction Lab. But tenants' lawyers in the country's less populated regions say they are also handling more cases now that the federal moratorium on evictions has expired. States like West Virginia, South Dakota, Delaware, and Arkansas have been slow to dole out rental assistance from the federal government, money that's meant to be a levy holding back a flood of evictions. Nationwide, only about 34% of the $45 billion Congress sent to states and cities for rental assistance had been distributed by October 31st, according to data from the U.S. Department of the Treasury. Other pots of money have been slow to be spent too, including $9 billion the Department of Housing and Urban Development sent to states and cities to combat housing-related COVID-19 fallout. Brent Thompson, executive director for East River Legal Services, which provides representation to low-income residents in eastern South Dakota, said, "My frustration is widespread. It's just sad when you see a continuing problem day in and day out, and there is only so much you can do for them." Thompson said the biggest hurdle he has faced in South Dakota is lack of information for tenants, many of whom were living in poverty before COVID-19 swept through the state. Thompson said, "We have developed a culture where people don't tend to avail themselves for protections afforded to them. this isn't a new problem. It's a problem that's being magnified by the pandemic and reaching a crisis point because of the pandemic. Back when the federal eviction moratorium was in place, people living in South Dakota tended to simply move elsewhere when their landlords threatened to evict, rather than fight for their right to stay, Thompson said. And many tenants either don't know about the state's $200 million rental assistance allocation from the federal government or haven't been able to access those funds. As of October 31st, only 4% of that money had been distributed to tenants and landlords, according to data from the U.S. Department of the Treasury. A November report from the National Low Income Housing Coalition placed South Dakota and Wyoming last among states for the share of rental assistance they had sent to tenants and landlords. The South Dakota Housing Development Authority, which is administering the state's rental assistance programs, has distributed aid to more than 5,200 households with money from the federal government, said Amanda Weiss-Graham, spokesperson for the agency. The state approved 75% of the completed applications it received. Weiss-Graham noted the need for assistance isn't as acute in South Dakota because the state's businesses weren't forced to close during the pandemic and residents weren't required to stay home. But Thompson's office saw a 30% jump in eviction cases for 4 months in a row earlier this year, and he said the need for attorneys is growing. Only 8 attorneys cover this 33-county region, which spans 30,000 square miles. His territory is home to a large population of undocumented migrant workers and indigenous people, groups that have historically been exploited by landlords. South Dakota ranks last in terms of access to legal representation, according to the National Center for Access to Justice. In Delaware, landlords have been hesitant to sign up for rental assistance programs, said Dan Atkins, executive director of Community Legal Aid Society Incorporation. Landlords have balked at providing financial records to the state government, and they haven't wanted to give up the right to evict tenants in exchange for receiving rental payments. You can drag a horse to water, but you can't make them drink, Atkins said. We will drag them to the water, but we don't know if they will drink. Many of the lowest income tenants in Delaware don't know about the rental assistance available to them. They don't have reliable access to internet, and some people aren't able to read, Atkins said. All of this is a challenge when the state requires pages of documentation proving financial hardship. Plus, there is a narrative in the low-income community that no one is going to help, he said. Over 80% of landlords are represented in eviction cases in Delaware, Atkins said, while fewer than 5% of tenants have lawyers by their side. There is not enough legal aid to go around. Atkins said, we are starting to see the floodgates open a bit, and we are looking over our shoulder and wondering if it's going to be a big tidal wave soon. As of October 31st, only 10% of Delaware's $200 million allocation in rental assistance had been doled out to tenants and landlords, according to data from the Treasury Department. In Arkansas, state officials were lagging behind most other states for the first 7 months of the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, but they picked up the pace of distributing money in October, Treasury Department data show. Still, that's only used up 22% of the state's $174 million allocation. The public badly needs access to rental assistance funds, said Kendall Levington, housing subject area manager for the Center for Arkansas Legal Services, adding that the state amended its policies to make it easier for tenants to access the aid. He said, "I just hope that it isn't too late for most people." As of October 15th, Levin's office had handled twice as many landlord-tenants cases in 2021 as it did in the same period in 2020. Eviction in Arkansas is uniquely punitive. Levin said it's the only state in the U.S. that charges tenants with a crime for failing to pay their rent and vacate their home. Nearly 450 people were charged with that misdemeanor crime between March 2020 and November 2021 in Arkansas, according to data from the state's court system. Of those, 133 were found guilty. Back in West Virginia, Schaffer and Pasco went living in a neighborhood littered with rotting tires and stacks of lumber. The house next door was shrouded by dead vines. As of December 15, they hadn't found a place they could afford to rent, and they were thinking they had have to spend the night outside. They didn't apply for rental assistance because the process would take weeks to complete, and Pasco's income as a handyman in the flooring business had dried up. So had the income of Johnny Harrell, who was in the tree trimming business in nearby Charlestown. Harrell said his employer died and he was suddenly out of work. He said he had never missed a rental payment before, but he could no longer afford to pay $500 a month. His landlord, Alex Salgado, purchased a small building Harrell was living in about 18 months ago. Harrell was the first person he had to evict. Salgado said, "It's a circle, right? I need to get money in so I can pay for the building." Like Schaffer and Pasco, Harrell found out the day before Thanksgiving that he would be evicted by December 3rd. He didn't want to move into his son's home, which was already crowded. The only place he could think to live was inside an old pop-up camper on a nearby campground. It isn't insulated, and the temperatures were already dropping below freezing at night. At the last minute, Harold's relatives helped him rent an apartment in Maryland, so he wouldn't have to sleep in the camper. "It felt loosey," Harold said of his experience in a courtroom. "You work all your life and you're fine, and you keep going no matter what happens. And you know what? It was heartbreaking."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.